After the U.S. military withdrew from Vietnam, many people in Southeast Asia faced imprisonment or worse from the ruling communist regime. This hour, how many of them came to Iowa? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I'll talk with former U.S. Ambassador to Cambodia, Kenneth Quinn. He'll set the scene in post-Vietnam America and explain how he worked with then-Iowa Governor Robert Ray on resettling refugees. Then in the second half hour, we'll meet one of those original refugees now living in Des Moines. Also, Matthew Walsh will be with us, author of The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we travel back more than four decades to visit America and Iowa immediately after the end of the Vietnam War, to see how our state and our then-governor, Robert Ray, played a pivotal role resettling refugees from Southeast Asia. In the second half hour, we'll meet one of those original refugees who is now living in Des Moines, Som Bakom. Also joining us, Matthew Walsh. He's a professor of history at the Des Moines Area Community College and author of The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. First, a conversation I had recently with former U.S. Ambassador to Cambodia, Kenneth Quinn. Quinn spent 32 years working for the U.S. State Department, and during that time, he also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, as well as a member of the National Security Council staff at the White House. Kenneth Quinn is now president of the World Food Prize in Des Moines. After the U.S. military withdrew from Vietnam in the 1970s, many of the native people who supported the U.S. war effort in Southeast Asia faced torture, death, and imprisonment from the ruling communist regime. So I began my conversation with Ambassador Quinn by asking him to further set the scene right after the Vietnam War.
I remember it very vividly, and I think the most important thing for listeners to understand is how bitterly divided the United States was by the Vietnam War. Over 50,000 of our military died there. There was enormous debate about whether we should be there or not. And then it ended in a terrible fashion with the U.S. having to essentially flee Saigon as the North Vietnamese came and took over the country, and there was about 130,000 Vietnamese and others from Laos who managed to escape now, and the sense of freedom was gone, and communism took over Vietnam. So this America in 1975, April 30th was the day of the North captured and raised its flag in the South, and there's 130,000 Indo-Chinese who are on ships and making their way brought by towards the United States to be resettled, people who had made it to freedom. And I think there was that, on the one hand, a sense of obligation to these refugees that, after all, we had been involved in the middle of the war, and they were coming here, and that we should do the right thing. But there was debate even about that. And President Ford, who's not elected, pulled the country together, decided, yes, we should take these refugees and resettle them, and the government's assistance would be behind them. And so as the refugees arrived in the United States, they were taken to different military facilities where they would be processed, given social security numbers, given some orientation, and then they were going to be sent around on a proportion basis to every state, so that every state would share in proportion to its size in the burden of receiving these people, all Asians. America wasn't a country with a huge Asian element. in it, not certainly as familiar as and as many Asians as there are now in America. And so here they are arriving. Few speak English, unfamiliar with our customs, with our way of life, and with our weather, and to be resettled and hopefully assimilated and begin new lives here in America. Mm-hmm. That's the setting, that's the stage in 1975.
And then specifically in 1975 with Iowa's then Governor Robert Ray, how did you work with him? What was your involvement in helping to resettle refugees specifically in Iowa?
In 1975, I was working at the White House on the National Security Council staff as a professional foreign service officer. I was very deeply involved in the evacuation of Saigon. I had been there just a couple of weeks before the end. I was involved in the process of refugees coming to the United States. And so what happened in Iowa, and what's unique about Governor Ray in that first period, is that Iowa was going to get its several thousand refugee share of that 130,000 that were coming, but refugees would be randomly resettled. Families, of course, would be kept together, but the country wasn't going to take whole provinces or villages or clans or anything. No, they would be divided up and resettled. And so what happened was there was a small group of refugees from Laos who were ethnically and linguistically different from the Vietnamese and from Laos, and they were called the Thai Dam. And they ended up in one camp because they had gotten out together, and so they're here about to be resettled and realize they're about to be scattered all around the United States. The people who share their customs, share their language, share their kinship affiliations are all going to be who knows where, you know, scattered in many states. And so in desperation and assisted by an Iowan named Arthur Crisfield, they write to about 30 American governors saying, won't you please take us as a people, as an ethnic group, and resettle us? Now, no governor had the power to do that. Governors couldn't decide who they got. The federal government was deciding who they received. And the only governor who answered them was Bob Ray. Governor Ray read the letter, felt badly, said, maybe we can help. And he goes and lobbies in Washington. So he's a Republican. He lobbies with President Ford and the Republican administration. And they say, okay, you, Governor, you, Iowa, you can have all the Thai Dam. So the Thai Dam refugees, this distinct ethnic group from Laos, are suddenly going to be on planes, all coming to Des Moines. Now, Governor Ray believed people should have work. And so he created within Iowa state government an agency. This is unheard of. Nobody did this. No state did this before or since. And he created a unit in Iowa state government in what was called the Department of Job Service, and it was headed by a wonderful woman named Colleen Shearer. And he said, Colleen, you are going to be the one to receive these refugees, help them. You're going to find sponsors, churches, families for them, and we're going to find jobs for them. And that was what Governor Ray did.
Well, just to tell us a little bit about why it was so important, or perhaps the arguments that Governor Ray was convinced by that it was important to keep this ethnic group, the Thai Dam, together. Many people, I think, would think, well, so what would be the consequence of breaking them up and keeping families together but distributing them across the United States?
Yes. Well, they made a compelling case, and I think Governor Ray was a man with incredible, and is a man today, with incredible compassion, and was interested in problems that would come to him and believed that government could be a good force to help people who weren't able to get help anywhere else. And I think he understood that people coming in this circumstance would have lost so much in terms of their reference to their culture. They were plucked up and dropped down in the middle of nowhere, that having people who to preserve your culture, preserve your ways, preserve your language, your traditions, was important and would help all of them by being near each other. And there was, you know, no political advantage to this, but he saw positive action to do a good thing, and that's, you know, he's one of the campaign slogans for him was a good man doing a great job, and that really comes home true about the refugees. He was a good man, and he was doing a great job in going that extra step. And you see this throughout his working with refugees, because this was phase one. Now, after the Thai Dom got here, they were here about 6 months, and they had a celebration around the new year, and they invited President Ford to come. And the president, of course, couldn't come, but I came to represent the president in the White House. I brought a letter. I'm at the ceremony. I'd never met Governor Ray. And I get up and I read the president's letter. I say good words about what Iowa's doing, about refugees and how welcoming. And I go to sit down, and Governor Ray says, "Oh, that was those are great remarks. We sure could use a guy like you out here." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yes." So I went back to Washington. I found there was a program by which career Foreign Service officers like me could be loaned to a state. I applied for it, and then in 1978, the State Department loaned me to the state of Iowa to work in Governor Ray's office. And in that capacity, I then worked with him on the next two phases of the refugee issue in 1979, which was the boat people and the starving, emaciated Cambodians who were helped through what was called Iowa Shares.
Having dealt with many facets of refugee resettlement in the 1970s, stemming from Southeast Asia, what were the biggest challenges looking back?
Schools. First of all, for the schools to receive so many students who couldn't work in English. You know, now we talk about, oh, there's 30 languages spoken in Des Moines public schools or so. That wasn't the case in 1975 at all. And so schools had to adjust. How do we find teachers? How do we take students and start to teach them English and start to let them come into into the mainstream of education? Law enforcement. How does law enforcement work? So different. People had different views of the police and how the police acted and whether the police were corrupt in Vietnam and Laos. And I remember getting up in Dubuque. I speak Vietnamese and talking to refugees and telling them, hey, it's not like in Vietnam. The police here in America are really, you know, honest and straightforward. And then the police wondered what I was saying in this foreign language, so I would have to tell them that in English what I had just said. So there were things like that. And then finding jobs, employers, how do we deal with people like this? And so you'd find companies would give them a chance, and they'd say, oh, these are hardworking people. They're ready to do the job. They're eager to learn. So, having a welcoming, caring family or church or organization who would take refugees in. You know, Iowa Public Television did this hour-long program about refugees being resettled, and they highlighted a farm family who had taken them in. And 25 years later, refugees show up, and they're like the extended kin of that family. And Iowa families and Iowans were so welcoming and so wonderful, and it could never have happened without the sponsors, without the churches, and churches of all and temples of all faiths being involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, as president of the World Food Prize based in Des Moines, I wonder how often, Ambassador Quinn, do you encounter the refugees or their descendants from Southeast Asia as Iowans?
So I'll tell you about World Food Prize event that we had a dinner in Cedar Falls. We had dinner in West Des Moines to highlight Governor Ray and Vice President Mondale's work on refugees. So this is like in 2008 or so. And We had 300, 400, 500 people there. And at the end, we brought in a group of Asians, Asian refugees, Asian immigrants, 40, 50 of them, and they stood as a group and sang the Iowa Corn Song, which was Norman Borlaug's favorite song. It's the song about being an Iowan, what it means to be an Iowan. And the here, all these Asian refugees standing there, they've got their Iowa hats on, and their singing is the same passion and emotion that you would, that I would, about, you know, being from the land where the tall corn grows. And it captured for me and for everybody who was there that being from Iowa is something that transcends whatever your ethnicity is, your race is, whatever the color of your skin, that you come here, you become part of Iowa, everybody can be an Iowan. And it was this magic moment that brought it home in a way that words can't, couldn't do. I guess the other point I would make is I mentioned that America was such a divided country at the end of the war, that the refugee effort brought people together, whether they were for the war, against the war. It was this humanitarian effort of alleviating suffering, of giving people a new home, of helping unfortunate people who had no place to go, that brought everybody together, and it helped heal the wounds of division, the wounds of that war, in a way that few other things could.
Of course, we have a very divided country now, more than 40 years after the events that you're talking about. Given how you've helped refugees in the past, the work you've been involved in, what's your take? What are your thoughts on the climate in our country now regarding refugees?
So I think we have to understand the difference that refugees in 1975 to 80, there was a sense of obligation that everybody who was coming in these movements were suffering under communism, they were coming for freedom, and so there was a sympathy towards that. There also was the story that Vice President Mondale told, a great moment, of how in 1939 America had turned its back on a ship called the Ship St. Louis, which was filled with Jews coming, trying to escape the Holocaust, escape Nazism, and came to America's doors and were turned away and sent back to Europe and back under the Nazis and to a fate of, for probably for many of them, the gas chamber. And there was a unity in the sense of saying, never again, we can never let this happen, that America's glory is that we accepted people. So I've dealt with terrorism for much of my career. Terrorism is an incredible threat to our country. 9/11 changed things dramatically. I appreciate that. What's important, though, is it's right to scrutinize. It's right to be sure we check. It's right to verify. But my hope is that since it's part of America's DNA, to accept migrants, to accept people of all these different religions, that America is made up of all these different parts, that we find a way, at the same time that we want to be careful and safe, that we never say we don't want to take any more refugees. We don't want to take migrants. We don't want to turn people away as we turned away Jews in 1939 because of their religion, because that was the reason they were turned away in 39. And it's important, while being safe, to preserve the essence of what our country's been about and what Governor Ray was about, what Governor Ray's work on behalf of the boat people, because when the boat people were escaping in 1979, no country in the world, including the United States, would take any more refugees. No refugees were going to be able to come into the U.S., even though they were escaping communism on these frail boats and trying to escape to countries in the South China Sea. And there was this incredible show on TV that Governor Ray saw in January of 79, where the journalist Ed Bradley captured on video a boat being pushed into the ocean. The ocean waves are so big it breaks it up. The refugees are drowning before your eyes. And at 11 o'clock at night, Governor Ray was so tormented by that scene that that night we wrote a letter to the president that he signed, and he read in the morning to the press and said, if you, Mr. President, President Carter, will just reopen America's doors, Iowa will double the number of refugees we have accepted. And he was the first governing ruler anywhere in the world to commit to accepting the boat people refugees.
Another facet of this that we haven't talked about, tell us about Iowa Shares and your involvement there.
Sure. 2 weeks after Pope John Paul II visited Iowa, I went with Governor Ray on a trip to Asia, to China, and Thailand to visit refugee camps. In Thailand, we were unexpectedly taken out to a camp at the Cambodian border, and before our eyes, there were 30,000 starving, emaciated Cambodians who had just escaped from that country where they had lived under the genocidal Pol Pot Khmer Rouge. They were dying before our eyes at the rate of 50 to 100 a day, bodies plowed into mass graves. Governor Ray took pictures of this, photos, came back, gave them to the Des Moines Register. The pictures spread like an electric current across the state. People became so taken with the incredible plight. Religious leaders came to see the governor. What can we do? And governor asked me, and I came up with an idea of Iowa Shares, sends help, aid refugees, end starvation. The Register, radio stations, TV, churches, everyone started talking about this. People sent money in, small amounts, from many, many families. We raised well over $500,000 and rushed food, medicine there that arrived on Christmas Day. And for the next 2 years, we sent doctors, nurses from Iowa to keep Cambodians alive and to feed them and try to save as many as we could. So between helping the Thai Dom, saving the boat people, refugees from Vietnam, and feeding starving Cambodians, that's the legacy of Robert D. Ray.
What a pleasure it's been to have you share these remembrances. Ambassador Kenneth Quinn, thank you so much.
Ben, thanks for having me.
My recent conversation with Ambassador Kenneth Quinn. Coming up after a short break, we'll meet one of those original refugees now living in Des Moines. Her name is Soam Bakom. We'll also be joined by Matthew Walsh. Walsh is a professor of history at the Des Moines Area Community College and author of The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. Walsh will tell us more about how in 1975, when the Thai Dom, that ethnic group from northern Vietnam, campaigned for sanctuary by writing letters to 30 U.S. governors, only Iowa's Robert Ray agreed to help. We'll hear that story when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a trip back to the 1970s, so to speak, to hear about Iowa's long history of resettling refugees in the 1970s, refugees from Southeast Asia in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, after the U.S. military withdrew from Vietnam in the 1970s. Many of the native people who supported the U.S. war effort in Southeast Asia faced awful things, torture, death, imprisonment from the ruling communist regime, and that set up this refugee crisis of the 1970s. Joining us this half hour is one of the refugees who found her way to Iowa in that time. Soam Bacom is with us, a Tai-Dam refugee. We'll explain what the Tai-Dam ethnic group is in just a few minutes, if you weren't here in our first half hour. Came in 1975, now an RN living in Des Moines. Soam Bacom, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having me today.
Matthew Walsh is with us as well in our Des Moines studio, author of the new book, The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. He's a professor of history at the Des Moines Area Community College. Matthew, thank you for coming in.
No problem. Glad to be here, Ben.
I want to have you pick up and tell us about the Tai-Dam in just a moment. But first, let's get some early remembrances from you, Soam. You have lived in Iowa since 1975, but you were born in Laos or Vietnam, or you lived your early years, your first 11 years in parts of both?
No, I was born in Vientiane, Laos, and then I came to the United States when I was 11 years old, in October of 1975.
So you're 11 years old, you arrive in Iowa. What do you think when that plane lands and you step out?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, when our little trip, our journey to America, when we were at a refugee camp, they showed us some movies and, you know, they showed pictures of Hollywoods and Californias and beaches. And that's what the vision that I had in my head, that what America was going to look like coming to Des Moines, Iowa on October 27th, 1975. It was kind of cold, rainy day. And I stepped out. I said, I don't think we're in America. So it was kind of, I had some anxiety, anxious moment, but yet it was so much excitement and just so much things I was looking forward to, but I was like a little bit surprised because I was looking for the bright sunny oceans and the beaches and the Hollywood sign. I didn't see it.
We're all looking for those bright sunny beaches when it's October, November, December here in Iowa.
Yeah.
You lived with a host family. Where did you live with the family? Who were they?
Yes, we had the sponsor name Clayton and Ruby Gabrielson, and then the co-sponsors was also the Senti, Becky and Sam Senti, and then Emmanuel Lutheran Church was also helping with sponsorship for my family. There were six of us.
Mm-hmm. This was in Story City?
Story City, Iowa, yes.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to meeting Americans for the first time? Well, I know you had previously, but in Iowa, getting to know Americans, Iowans up close.
Well, you know, at first we weren't, you know, sure what the physique was going to be. You know, we really didn't get a lot of education of, you know, what the Western world was like. So when we first came, you know, most of us in the Asian community were fairly short people. You know, if you're 5'9 or 5'8, you're fairly tall for where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first time I, you know, walked out of the plane, saw all these people in this beautiful different colors of hairs and eyes, and then you have men over 6 feet tall, and we're just like, oh wow, this is phenomenal. It's kind of scary, thinking, where are we? You know, there's so many people that's so much taller and bigger than us. You know, it was very, like I said, mixed feelings. But and you know, to really get so anxious to see different colors of skins and eyes and hair, and it just was exciting in itself.
Matthew Walsh, your book, The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa, took a long time to create here. You interviewed more than 30 refugees and officials to come up with this account. I wanted to read just the final paragraph of your preface before having you tell us something, because I think this is really encapsulates what you have in this book. In the pages that follow, you write, readers will be walked through some of the darkest chapters in human history. Rape in Southeast Asia, starvation in Pol Pot's killing fields, torture in communist prison camps, death in the Indochina Wars, and racism in America are detailed. Nevertheless, the chronicle of refugee resettlement in Iowa is ultimately a positive one. That's because of the humanitarianism of a governor, the compassion of many Iowans, and most importantly, the resiliency of the refugees. Tell us the story as we met a little bit, Soam here, her background coming to Iowa. Who are the Tai-Dam? This is a story you set out to answer the question of how Iowa became home to the largest Thai Dom population outside of Asia.
Yeah, the Thai Dom are very understudied. So if you go to your local library and ask for a book on the Thai Dom, they'll look at you and say, well, we don't really know what's going on there. So a big goal of the book was to kind of explain who this group is. So the Thai Dom are similar to the Thai from Thailand. So Thai Dom means black Thai. And that comes from the distinctive clothing worn especially by the females. And if you go to some events, Thai New Year, or if you go to the Thai village, you will see the women sometimes wearing this traditional garb. So they're similar to the Thai and the Lao of Thailand and Laos. What the difference is traditionally, the Thai Dom rejected Buddhism. So they were ancestor worshippers. They believed the human body was comprised of spirits. And when we die, some of those spirits ascend into heaven, and others remain behind, and they would venerate the spirits of their lost loved ones at altars in their homes. So that's kind of a basic overview of the group, who, as that kind of preface was talking about, especially the elders, they went through so much trauma because in Vietnam, you had the French who were fighting against the communists. The Thai Dom, who ultimately arrived in Iowa, sided with the French. And for this, they faced reprisals. And so what they did after the fall of Dien Bien Phu, they fled to Laos, and they rebuilt their lives starting in 1954. And lo and behold, kind of like that domino theory coming to fruition, you had North Vietnam fall to communism, and then you had Laos fall to communism. And before that tips over, their leaders say, we have to get out of here or we're going to face persecution. We might be killed. So their leaders orchestrated an escape into Thailand. And that's where they went and wrote letters to the governors. They sent officials to France. They wrote to Canada. They did a lot of campaigning. And Governor Ray certainly is very important for accepting them, but they have a lot of important leaders that did a lot of great work, people like Wing Kam, Hung Bakam and Faluang Bakam really helped keep this group together and petition for asylum as a group in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. How many Thai Dom live in Iowa or came over originally, I guess, is a good question, too.
Okay, in the first 2 years, so 1975 to 1977, about, 1,228 Thai Dom came to our state in those first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And today, a rough estimate, maybe a little under 10,000 Thai Dom are living in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Also, it's important to keep this group distinct from what I think you'll agree, better known in the media at least, the boat people coming later in the 1970s, right? This is the different group.
Yeah, and people tend to lump the Thai Dom together with everybody else. Vietnam is very diverse, so the group who came to Iowa, the Thai Dom, are from Northwest Vietnam, but they're a minority group. So Vietnam has over 50 different ethnic minorities, and the Thai Dom are the second largest one. The dominant ethnic group is the Kin, and you would spell that K-I-N-H. And then there were a lot of ethnic Chinese people who were losing businesses. So a lot of Kin and ethnic Chinese are the ones who fled as boat people. But people in Iowa and everywhere else, they kind of just lump the Thai Dom together with the Vietnamese. But they are distinct, and unfortunately, not a lot of people know much about this group, and the book hopes to change that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, as a member of the Thai Dom group that came to Iowa in the mid-1970s. Did you have a sense as an 11-year-old what you were fleeing, that there was danger? Did you witness anything that was frightening in your homeland that told you, yes, the elders are right, we have to leave this area?
Yes, absolutely, because my parents, you know, always instructed us. I was the oldest of the family with my two brothers and one sister, and I was pretty much responsible for them when my parents were away at work. And when during the Vietnam War that was going on, my father had worked at diplomatic embassy in Laos, and he would get a lot of information. And my parents would always tell us, they made each one of us a bag that we can carry across our body. We had a pair of shoes, we had shirt and, you know, just very everyday clothing that we would need. And we had that at foot of the bed. Every night we just leave it there, and sometimes we'll put food or, you know, things seems more tense, my parents would put some food and stuff in that bag. And they always remind us when we hear if any bomb goes off, or you still hear, you hear all kinds of loud noises or people's running or just, you know, confusion, then I was responsible to grab my sister. And then my second brother was responsible to grab my youngest brother. And we had like a 6-foot hole in our backyard in case if the bomb would go off, and I was be responsible to get my sister and run into the hole and just jump in there with our bags across our body. And that's what they told us. And, you know, it was just one May evening, 8 o'clock, my father drove with his work truck and came over and said to my family, hey, we're leaving now. Go get your bag. Get in the car. We're leaving. We're getting ready to cross the river in a few days to go to Nong Khai because the war, you know, communist is coming and we don't want to be here. And that was the last time I ever had to see home.
Mm. You haven't been back since?
I did. I went back in December 2010.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Well, it was very emotional at first as I stepped off, you know, to go back to your homeland that you've been gone for 36 years. It just, even though I was 11 years old, I remember a lot, you know.
And you remembered the landscape or buildings or people?
Nothing at all. When I went, everything was so different because the house, my mom took us to where I was born in. It's called Wat Thai. That's where the internet at the Lao International Airport is at. And the place I lived and was born, I remember the floods and everything, but I didn't see anything that looked familiar at all. But I did see a bush of bamboos that was still there that I do remember always playing hide-and-go-seek there with my brothers and sisters.
Mm, interesting. Now, Matthew Walsh, you interviewed a number of refugees for your book, The Good Governor. Is Soam's experience typical? Or what other stories come to mind for you to add to Soam's?
A Soam story is fairly typical, but people like her parents, they went through a lot more in North Vietnam. There was a lot of intense fighting in the early 1950s between the communists and the French and their Thai Dom allies. And so people really, really faced separation. Some people were forced into marriages that they didn't want. There's a lot of potential for danger. People remember sleeping under rock shelters as there's bombs going off. So there's this real intense war that's going on, and the Thai Dom are caught in the middle of it. And they go to Laos, and the goal is to protect their children from enduring what they had endured. And they're very cautious. And when there's this hint that communism is going to spill over into Laos, the group wants to get out again immediately, and that's what they do. And I think a lot of that was looking after their children so that they wouldn't have to experience as intense trauma as they had endured.
Do you have a story, Matthew, that demonstrates sort of a theme that of integration here in Iowa by the Thai Dom? What did you find out? You talked to them about their experiences here in Iowa and adopting it as a new home.
I have an interesting story about actually Soam's family. She was sponsored by one guy named Gisselquist. He was a reverend in Story City at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, and he actually passed away in 1979. And years later, Soam's father passed away, and Gisselquist's wife donated a plot for Soam's father. And so here you have guys that were born thousands of miles away from very different culture, and yet they're resting in peace in a Story City, Iowa cemetery. And I just, you know, I think that's a moving story.
Mm. Soam, what did that mean to your family? It's been talked about, I imagine, quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. When our father passed away, and Borkeo Gisquez, who is the wife of Pastor Bob Gisquez, had told Mortician that they had two plots left and that they would be happy to donate the pieces of the land to my parents, and, you know, and if we would accept it. When the mortician came and spoke to my mom, and she was just in tears, and she felt so happy and more of anything, very, very honored to even have the beloved pastor's wife, I mean, beloved pastor and his wife, to so much love us, and that just shows us how much they love us to donate that plot to us, and they're just happy. And my mom, you know, she's got her place marked right next, and my father laying there next to the pastor. When I go visit the grave, every time I go, I bring fresh flowers and both just not my father, but I did it for pastor as well, just because that's how much he meant to us. Even though, like Matt said, we were far different from each other, thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of miles, but with what they show us and taking care of us when we first came to Story City and as a church, how much they made us feel and welcomed us. We just really appreciate it. And we always, forever, will be in debt to them, and most importantly, to Governor Ray. No mm. one will ever forget him in the Tidom community.
And you know some of Governor Ray personally. You still, to this day.
I do. I visit him every so often. I'm going to visit him, try to visit him more than, you know, just a few months here and there, because he means a lot to me, you know. I've got to know him personally and professionally when we worked together, when he was able, we traveled together to churches and meetings and places that he would have me speak about my experience coming as refugees. And, you know, I have a lot of ambition and interest in political arena. And when I first ran for the Des Moines School Board, when I served on it, and, you know, to get in political when you've never even done anything like that before, I had a lot of questions I asked him. And, you know, one of the best advice and quotes he gave me, and I always had that since 2002 when I ran for school board, I was on it, and it was a lot of hard decisions we had to make during the cut across the board statewide. And I called him. I said, Governor, I just feel so bad that we had to budget cut. We had to cut this department, do that department. And you know what he said to me? He said, Sam, always remember when I brought you people here to this country, I did it with my heart. I took a lot of risk of not being elected again. But all I know is I can tell you, if you do make decisions with your heart, you know that's the right decision. So, going into political arena, I remember those advice and quotes, and really does help me a lot, because I really do believe that Governor Ray really made the decision to bring the Tidom people here is with his heart.
Mm. Matthew Walsh, unfortunately, we've got just 2 or 3 minutes left, but you say in your book, after reading all the documents, you've concluded that Robert Ray is one of the most overlooked humanitarians of the 20th century. Quickly explain that. Take us back perhaps to the 70s. Psalm mentioned risk. It was highly divisive, wasn't it, to bring so many refugees right here to the heartland?
Sure. You know, during his governorship, about 8,000 refugees will be resettled in the state. The governor's state program was in charge of 4,000 of those, and the other 4,000 were supervised by the state. So he helped a lot of people in that way. As Kenneth Quinn talked about, he wrote letters to President Carter. He wrote letters to other governors to do more to help these boat people who are hurting. And he agreed to take 1,500 extra refugees in 1979. And then he visits the camps, sees people starving to death in Cambodia. They start Iowa Shares, of which Ken Quinn was a big part of, and they raised $540,000. He went to the UN meeting in Europe and advocated for greater admission of refugees. He's just done so much, and I think it's a story that is known by some knowledgeable Iowans, but it's not known enough and in as much detail. And hopefully this book will change that, and more work that is in similar nature can be done to really show his humanitarianism and also our diverse communities here in Iowa, which, of course, is part of his legacy of bringing.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we have to go, I really only have half a minute for each of you to reflect on, given your perspective, Psalm, you as a refugee yourself from the 1970s, how do you interpret the climate we have in the United States right now? Also, highly politicized, a lot of divisiveness.
Well, from what I've seen and what I watch, you know, I'm pretty heartbroken, because I thank the Lord every day that during the time in 1975 that we have a president that would open up his arms and hands, you know, to welcome these people, you know, just so the world knows that refugees, we're not looking for anything. We just want a place to survive, a place to give our family a second chance at life. That's all it is. No anything else.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Matthew Walsh, a big factor in between that experience and the current experience is 9/11, and that terrorism has become part of our daily life.
Yeah, the 40-year anniversary of the Thai Dom in Iowa, as this celebration was going on, Governor Branstad at the time announced that the state should stop resettling Syrian refugees. And I disagree with that. I think that if there are groups out there that help advocate, help U.S. political, economic, and military interests, that we have an obligation to help these individuals find asylum if they're persecuted. And although terrorism is there, it's a legitimate threat, we can still screen these people, and travel bans and blocking refugees from certain states is just the wrong way of dealing with those fears.
Matthew Walsh, historian, professor of history at the Des Moines Area Community College. His book, The Good Governor, Robert Ray and the Indo-Chinese Refugees of Iowa. Matthew Walsh, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thanks, Ben.
Saum Bakhom is with us as well, a Thai Dom refugee, now an RN living in Des Moines, as she said, very politically active. Saum, thank you for making your way to us in 1975, you and your family. It sounds like you're doing well, and we wish you all the best, and thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you so much, Ben. And you know what, Iowans, thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
All right. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.